This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to The Bigger Picture on BFM 89.9. Today, we'll be speaking with Dr. Gerhard Hofstetter, a lecturer of anthropology at the University of Queensland, who specialized his research in the area of identity politics and pluralism in Southeast Asia, including extended periods in Malaysia. So we wanted to speak with him about the recent shift in Australian politics and the potential effects on Malaysian immigrants and immigration in the years to come.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Doctor, you've spoken recently that humanism might not play well in a political climate beset by parochial mindsets, referring to Australia. What did you mean by that, please?
That was in the recent interview, and I was responding to a comment by Malcolm Fraser that it was broadly around the notion of a shift in refugee politics. That's been a long time coming in a way, and you know, a shift in the broader picture of how refugees should be treated and what sort of moral obligations and humanistic obligations countries like Australia have in the region. And we're talking about Malcolm Fraser, of course, very important Prime Minister in Australia, who in the 70s made it possible for a lot of Vietnamese to be relocated or resettled to Australia. Now, that sort of program of resettling tens of thousands, and in the end it was over 100,000 refugees as part of a regional solution to the refugee crisis, is seen as a sort of grand gesture of a very hospitable, at least to refugees, countries such as Australia, and also the ability to absorb different people, Asian migrants or Asian refugees in this instance. And the point was that nowadays that narrative has really shifted, and it's shifted away from the Refugee Convention and the rights inherent therein, and shifted away from the obligation of richer countries in the world to resettle more refugees and to do more for refugees in their respective regions, be it Europe and refugees from North Africa and Arab countries, and you know, for Australia and New Zealand, obviously refugees in our region, which includes Southeast Asia. And nowadays, especially with the incoming government of Tony Abbott and the coalition government in Australia, there's a market shift towards border protection. So rather than being welcoming and open with open arms to the other and saying, yes, all right, you can come here, there's an emphasis on closing the border and patrolling it more and protecting our border from others even coming here by boat. And that was the main sort of shift I think we're talking about in terms of that narrative, and also in terms of the moral impetus to help others.
All right. Let's bring this around a bit to issues regarding immigration of Malaysians to Australia. Australia's historically perhaps had an image of itself as a multicultural nation and welcoming to immigrants. How much of that reputation do you feel is relevant today, given earlier this year in February, there were many media reports of a Malaysian-born Australian, Jeremy Fernandez, who also works at the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, who had racist abuse shouted at him in a public bus?
We have to make a distinction here from the very beginning about, you know, racism is almost universal. Everywhere we go, they're going to be racist people. So racist abuse towards people who look, speak, look differently are almost a universal human experience. So that's going to happen wherever you go. I think the bigger point is really about Australia's image and how Australia and Australians see themselves. And I think the imagery of Australia as this welcoming multicultural wonderland is actually a certain narrative, certainly not believed and enacted by everybody, but it's a certain narrative the government certainly has tried to spin over and over again. And in fact, it's also it's a narrative that a lot of countries like to spin about themselves. I mean, just look at Malaysia and the One Malaysia policy, right? Again, a sort of projection of inclusiveness, of a multicultural wonderland. You have it in the tourism ads, Malaysia truly Asia. And Australia is doing the same, or has been doing a similar sort of campaign around how Australia would like to be seen abroad. Obviously, within Australia, there are lots of problems with that narrative. You look at Indigenous Australia, for instance. the recognition of indigenous history pre-contact before 1788 is not really acknowledged. Just recently at the war memorial where Australian soldiers who've fallen in all kinds of war zones, often fighting for their imperial overlords, the British elsewhere in Europe and elsewhere, they're all recognized in this war memorial. But people who died in the frontier wars around the time of contact, when large swaths of Aboriginal populations were decimated, aren't even mentioned. So even in its own history telling, there are lots of problems in terms of what it means to be multicultural. And I think it's also interesting if you think about the history of multiculturalism itself, comes from Canada, and Canada's often deemed to be this other multicultural wonderland where people of all different backgrounds, ethnicities, appearance, language, religion, etc., can live together happily and peacefully. And to some degree, that's true. We haven't seen widespread discrimination of others, institutionalized discrimination of others that we've seen in other countries. But at the same time, if you look at where that history of multiculturalism starts in Canada, it starts, or it comes out of a sort of bi-cultural recognition. Because in Canada, there was a big contestation or tension between Francophone Quebec and English-speaking other parts of Canada. And so they thought, Quebec always wanted to, had a separatist movement, wanted to be independent from the rest of Canada. So Canadian policymakers wanted to include Quebec more and the Francophone minority. And they were thinking about policies to include other language groups. And when they were designing this policy in the late 60s, early 70s, they thought about it as a bicultural policy framework. But then they thought, well, what about all these indigenous people? We should really also include them. And then they kept thinking about it and thought, well, what about all those recent Asian migrants? We should really do something to include them also. And that's how multiculturalism really came out of thinking out of a monoculturalism, becoming a biculturalism, and then multiculturalism. And that's the policy side. And really, it's policies that are relevant for what is a multicultural reality. Most countries on the planet are multicultural countries these days, because lots of people with different backgrounds, different languages, different religions, etc., inhabit them. So I think it's really an issue around narratives. Now, Australia, if you look at other indicators, is still a fairly successful country in terms of making it a place where people can call their home, can actually cook their own food, and this is, again, multiculturalism is usually termed within the sort of weak multicultural imagery of, we usually talk about food, different food, because that's something we can eat and it's not that contentious. Food and cultural festivals, the sort of performance, people wearing different dresses and colorful things, and they dance around. And that's, every major city in Australia has multicultural festivals all the time. You have a Thai festival, a Malaysian festival, a Tibetan festival, whatever it may be, where ethnic minorities are sort of paraded, if you like, and to show and to reinforce that narrative that, yes, difference is amongst us and difference is good and it's okay and we can embrace it. But there's also lots of critics from the right who obviously are arguing that it leads to a dissolution of the Anglo-Celtic heritage, again, sort of ethnic arguments around the maintenance of the dominant Anglo-Celtic heritage. Mostly historians have really been at the forefront of that, John Hirst, Geoffrey Blainey, for instance. But there are also critics on the right, on the left, sorry, who don't see multicultural policy really going far enough, because it's just like a veneer. It sort of says, yes, we tolerate difference, but if we tolerate difference, we're tolerating it from a position of power. So the power still rests with the Anglo-Celtic majority, let's say, and a subset of that even. And so critics from the left would argue, well, we should really embrace the politics of negotiation amongst equals rather than this talk of tolerance of the other and tolerance of difference.
We've been speaking with Dr. Gerhard Hofstetter, a lecturer in anthropology at the University of Queensland, regarding some recent events in the news regarding immigration and refugee policy in Australia. Coming up, we'll explore a bit more in depth the experience of Malaysians in Australia and perhaps some trends emerging as we look towards the future. You're listening to The Bigger Picture on BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Gerhard Hofstetter, a lecturer of anthropology at the University of Queensland, who specializes research in the area of identity politics and pluralism in Southeast Asia, including extensive research in Malaysia. So we'll be speaking this part of the hour about the experience of Malaysians in Australia and some emerging trends in Australian society and politics. What is your overall impression on the experience that Malaysians have as they study and work in Australia? There's increasing, shall we say, anecdotal evidence of Malaysians feeling not always welcome in Australian society.
I'm not a Malaysian, so I'm probably not the best person to answer that question from a Malaysian point of view. But I have to say Malaysians continue to sort of go up in terms of statistics, in terms of migrating to Australia. They're one of the biggest groups of migrants to Australia, and I think in the last census there was about 135,000 Malaysian-born migrants living in Australia. And it's become a common trope, especially amongst the sort of middle and upper class of Malaysians, to have at least some of their kids go to Australia to study there, and then many of them, you know, stay back, hang around, get permanent residency, and many stay in Australia indefinitely. So I think there is some trend there. My personal sense is that some of the sort of push factors actually have a lot to do with Malaysia rather than Australia. In fact, Australia has become, for some, inhibitively expensive because the Australian dollar has skyrocketed in the last couple of years because of the resource prices. So studying in Australia has become much more expensive, hence a lot of Australian universities have opened campuses in Malaysia. Nonetheless, a lot of Malaysians still coming to Australia to live here, and I think Melbourne has the largest foreign-born population in Melbourne is, in fact, Malaysian. So Melbourne seems to be the capital of Malaysians in Australia. And I think there's two sorts of issues. One is the push factor that I mentioned. It has to do with what's happening in Malaysia and Malaysian politics and perhaps some dissatisfaction about Malaysian politics and not perhaps the rosiest of pictures of what the future holds for Malaysia, pushing people to seek employment or study options in Australia or elsewhere. So that's what's pushing some of the people. I think one of the pull factors is Australia is a fairly easy country, or continues to be relatively easy to come into and stay here. The visa regime has been curtailed under Labor a couple of years ago, following on from some reports about visa rorting of the 457 scheme, which is the skilled workers scheme. So it's getting harder and harder, and I suspect under the coalition that will only get even harder to sort of get in. But a lot of people still come as students and then stay on and get permanent residency. And as I said, Australia is a fairly easy country. I mean, I'm a migrant myself. I came from the UK to Australia as a student, and then hung around, as a lot of people do. Australia continues to be a major center of in-migration or of migration. It's easy to settle. English is obviously lingua franca for the world. A lot of people in Malaysia speak English. That's easy. I think a lot of people who want to continue certain cultural norms that they have, it's fairly easy to do that in Australia. Again, there for instance, there are Muslim schools in most urban centers. There are temples, you know, lots of different religious organizations, as well as national or ethnic organizations that people can join when they get here. So that form of multicultural organization, if you like, is quite strong in countries like Australia, and allows people to settle here successfully and integrate quite well into the larger Australian society. So I think that's going to continue. But I think the one issue is really push factors in Malaysia, and how things are going to pan out in Malaysia will perhaps to a larger degree influence those migration streams between Malaysia and Australia.
Okay, you talk about to a large extent, the integration of Malaysians in Australian society. Is your impression that Malaysians there feel like they belong in Australia, or are they fitting in to essentially bide their time, put their kids through school, have more career opportunities perhaps, or for whatever reason? Which of the two do you think most Malaysians would fit into, the belonging category or the fitting in category?
I think that's a terribly generalized question to ask an anthropologist, because anthropologists always answer, the first answer we have to give is, oh, it's much more complex than that. And we can't really generalize like that. I think what we can potentially generalize around is in terms of whether people are coming here for specific reasons such as skilling up, education, and then returning. So a lot of students who come here are on Patronas or government scholarships. That then bind them in coming back and working in Malaysia for X amount of years. So their experience is going to be very different from people who have come here to stay here. And I think a lot of the skilled migration is people leaving Malaysia for reasons that they don't feel they have a place in Malaysia anymore. They come to Australia where they feel, or some of them feel, that they have more of a sense of belonging than they had in Malaysia. And I think that also changes in terms of generational shifts. When you're young, you're more willing to move. As you get older, you might have more sense of homesickness and wanting to return and move back to your homeland, or what you see as your homeland. So I think there are lots of factors that influence those migration flows that go back and forth. But again, I think it's the interplay between what happens in Malaysia and what happens here. If Australian society was to become more racist, and it's already quite racist, but if it were to become more racist, and if it were to become more difficult for foreigners to have a sense of belonging here, then sure, people will probably move back to Malaysia. But I think that's not happening. In fact, racism is a huge issue in Malaysia, which is one of the push factors that I mentioned earlier, for a lot of people to actually leave Malaysia for Australia, who they deem to be more accepting of some people.
Do you think that Australian politics has any effect on the willingness of Malaysians to move to Australia, or other reasons completely independent of whoever's in power?
Well, I remember, this is the problem of popular culture. I'm perhaps too old. You might know was it one of the pop idols? He was a Malaysian-born guy who won an Australian. Probably wasn't a pop idol. It's one of the other shows. Do you remember Guy Sebastian? Is that his name? Anyway, it was big news, I think, for some, maybe not you, some Malaysians, that someone who was Malaysian-born had won an Australian pop, whatever it was. And similarly, when Penny Wong, not so much when she entered the Senate, but when she, you know, came to the front bench of cabinet and became finance minister, there was a recognition that, he is a Malaysian-born politician of renown, something to be proud of in terms of Malaysians making it in Australia. I think that the sort of personal stories, they connect. And you know, that's positive and negative. Negative stories, you know, politicians coming here, and University of Adelaide was embroiled in a bit of perhaps not a scandal, but about funding by the chief minister of Sarawak for the university, and issues that caused. So, you know, it has positive and negative headlines, if you like, that when people talk about these links between Malaysia and Australia, that come up every now and then. I think the broader politics in Australia don't really influence to a great deal decisions of migration, or because largely politics here don't change all that much. If you look at the two major parties, Labour and the Coalition, they, you know, ideologically they don't really differ all that much. So it's not like, you know, we're moving from a socialist country to a capitalist, or, you know, there aren't really great ideological battles being fought in politics these days in Australia. There's minor policy changes that make it easier, you know, with a coalition government for small businesses perhaps. And so if you're a Malaysian and you have a small business, that would be interesting for you. But other than that, you know, there are not big impacts to migrants between the policies of the two major parties. So I don't think that would have a huge impact.
Okay. Is there an equivalent of the American dream in Australia, the Australian dream? Is it a house with two-car garage and sending their kids to posh schools? Or what would it be for most Malaysians? What does it mean to make it in Australia?
I think the general Australian dream was always to have the house in the suburbs with your plot of land, enough maybe for one or two fruit trees, and yes, the car, the garage and everything. And a lot of people still aspire to that, but slowly it's dawning on most people that, A, the property prices are crazy, essentially, and that for a lot of people that dream will remain a dream. Much like the American dream remains a dream for the vast majority of people there. So people are getting used to renting. People are getting used to living in apartments rather than houses. So I think that's changing, but it's not necessarily a negative or a bad change. People are just getting more accustomed to a different lifestyle. But because Australia is generally a very urban country, although it doesn't look that way, but most people live in the big cities. It's not that different from the experiences of Malaysians who move here, especially those from Klang Valley, Penang, or Johor. You know, we have this not quite the same traffic jams as in KL, but we're getting there. Certainly in Melbourne, it's getting worse and worse. So I think in terms of lifestyle, there's people are being priced out in terms of, you know, living the dream, but I think people still aspire to it, and people will, as long as they aspire, will work towards that. I think one thing in Australia is there's still a relatively low unemployment rate, so people can get jobs, and that's obviously the main issue to sustain a lifestyle. So I think, you know, I'm a pessimist by nature, so the dream is probably more of a nightmare for most people who end up living it, and the majority of people don't live it anymore. So it's not a bad thing not to live the supposed dream that's in store for us.
Right. And it seems like many Malaysians face a turning point when they're in Australia a certain number of years and their parents start to age. And they're looking at whether they should pull up stakes and go back to Malaysia to look after their parents, or potentially either, you know, hire in full-time help back in Malaysia, or bring their parents to them in Australia. Is this a dilemma that you've heard much about? And do you think there's any accommodation in terms of the healthcare system in Australia, which is much more expensive for these types of considerations?
I mean, that's one thing about lifestyle, isn't it? Coming from, let's say, the Malaysian middle class and certainly upper class, most Malaysians either have had or have people have contact with people who have maids and domestic help. And in order to have domestic help in Australia, you have to be silly rich. I mean, the middle class certainly wouldn't have at least the sort of domestic help you have in Malaysia. Certainly no live-in maids. I mean, that's totally out of the question. People here have, you know, the people coming over to mow your lawn. So they have people to do certain odd jobs, but there's nowhere the support that you could afford here than in Malaysia. However, aged care is one of those issues where multicultural policies have been quite responsive lately to certain demands. Certainly not demands in terms of the level of care, because it's much more expensive here. But, for instance, there are several care homes now in Victoria and New South Wales that focus on Greek and Italian aged care. And so there's a provision for language, especially people who migrated in the 50s, 60s, who are now in, you know, the demand for aged care for these sort of migrants is going up. And a lot of them don't have the English proficiency, or as you get older with dementia, might lose the capacity to speak the second language. So it's crucial for there to be special provisions in aged care around language. And so that's happening slowly. It's costly, and it requires time. So perhaps that is something that over time may happen for the Malaysian community as well. It hasn't yet, but that, you know, as we can see it with some communities, other communities will follow. I think it's often just easier and cheaper for aged care to happen in Malaysia for the very reasons I mentioned a second ago. But I think there are provisions, and I think if you look at the healthcare system, it might be overall more expensive, but a lot of it is also paid for by taxes. So certainly if you have permanent residency or a citizen here, you have access to subsidized services around medical care and aged care. So I think there are ways around that, and it becomes perhaps more of an individual case-by-case issue. But as I mentioned earlier, homesickness is an issue that you know one can't underestimate in terms of where people ultimately feel at home. And you know, for some people it is here, it's in certain places here in Australia. For others, it's in Malaysia, and that's again a case by case sort of issue in terms of where. You know, it's an effective relationship with place that people have, and it may be where you grew up. It may be where you had the time of your life at a specific moment in time. It may be where you're living right now. So that's a very personal issue for most people.
And looking a bit externally outside of Australia, it seems like Australia oriented itself for majority of its history back to Europe. And then at a certain point, it started to wake up to the fact that geographically, it's got far more in common with Southeast Asia and the rest of Asia than with Europe. So how has this realization changed its orientation in terms of its neighbors and its place in the world?
That's a really huge question. But it's also very interesting. I think it really happened sort of in the 70s, late 60s, early 70s, around one issue was certainly the refugee issue. It was also the recognition that, an early recognition of that was really the fall of Singapore, because during the Second World War, Australia felt very vulnerable, and they had great hopes that the British would essentially be their security blanket for the advancing Japanese. And the moment the fortress of Singapore fell in 42, I think, was really a turning point in terms of, well, Britain is not as powerful as they thought it had been. And there was a turning away from Britain and a turning towards the US in terms of security. In terms of turning to the region itself, I think that happened later when the UK as an economic power was also failing, and the UK itself was divesting itself from the Commonwealth. And, you know, in the 50s and 60s, a lot of countries were becoming independent from the British Empire, and the British were investing themselves more and more in the European Union and in Europe more broadly. And so not really all that interested in Australia anymore. And Australia had to take that on board, I guess, and look around for new friends and found them in the region. But that relationship has really been strained at times, certainly with Malaysia during the Mahathir years. And you know, it goes through ups and downs, and I think it's potentially going through a bit of a valley of sorts with countries like Indonesia, because Australia continues to see itself as a bit of a not part of the region, and certainly not a partner for other countries in the region, but as, well, some people a while back called it the sheriff of the Pacific, and sort of the, a little bit of the, in a position of the odd one out. And certainly if you look at the way Australia is dealing with countries like Indonesia, but also Malaysia and others in the region around refugees, it's really saying, here's a domestic issue for Australia, boat people, right? People arriving by boat in Christmas Island and in Australia. This is our problem, but we would like to externalize our problem and make it your problem. So, okay, Indonesia, Malaysia, you're going to get Australian police officers stationed in your airports to stop people getting on planes coming to Australia. We're going to increase surveillance of the border, and we would like the Indonesians, in fact, to do that for us. And certainly the recent coalition policy around buying back boats that were unseaworthy, installing wardens in coastal areas to report and really act as intelligence officers for the Australian government. All of these sort of policies are externalizing the Australian border into the region, so that now, you know, regional countries like Malaysia, like Indonesia, will be responsible or partly responsible for keeping the Australian border secure. And I think that's a very one-sided sort of relationship. It's Australia is requesting help from you guys, and it's not a very partner-like engagement, let's say, where you would sit down and do something together. It's more Australia telling countries in the region how to do things. I mean, the Papua New Guinea deal, the potential Malaysia swap deal, these are all examples of Australia asserting itself in the region, usually with a checkbook, to get its way. And I don't think it's a very healthy way of engaging the region.
Any predictions for the next 5 years in terms of Malaysians in Australia or Australia's relations with Malaysia?
I think the relationship with Malaysia will move along smoothly. I don't think there are any things on the horizon that could unsettle that. I think the Malaysia swap deal on refugees is over, so that won't come up again. The coalition has a different policy, mainly with Indonesia. I think the major issue to look out for is in fact not in Australia, and I said this before, it's really in Malaysia, and how the Malaysian government can and will deal with its political landscape, let's say, and how it can manage its multicultural reality in ways that that are more inclusive for the majority of people, so that that process will impact the push factors that are pushing people away from Malaysia to come to Australia. And I think to a much greater degree than anything Australia is doing or can do in terms of that migration flow.
Thank you very much. We've been speaking to Dr. Gerhard Hofstadter, who's a lecturer of anthropology at the University of Queensland, and has specialized his research in the area of identity politics and pluralism in Southeast Asia, about the Australian dream and how Malaysia and Malaysians potentially could fit. You've been listening to The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.